does being in an underwater chase with one of the world's largest predators on Earth sound to you? Not fun, right? Well, that's exactly what happened to Tony Wu. Anyone would be forgiven for closing their eyes and hoping it was just a nightmare. But what did Tony do? He got his camera out and took a picture. You see, Tony is an award-winning wildlife photographer who captures marine life in breathtaking ways. We're talking giant fish traffic jams, the spawning rituals of starfish, and sea snails releasing hundreds of green eggs into the ocean. Parts of life on Earth we rarely get to see. Outlook's Emily Naylor spoke to Tony Wu.
How does it feel to be in this underwater world, which is essentially, from lots of your pictures, looks like an alien planet?
It is kind of like being in a different world. Maybe that's why I like it and other people like it. Everything is different from our normal lives. I mean, for one, you're silent in the sense that you can't speak with anybody usually. Basically, you are the most helpless thing there. You know, on land, we sort of, in many, most circumstances, we're not defenseless. I mean, we've made it that way. But when you're in the ocean, you're basically at the mercy of everything else there, from the actual water to the weather or in the currents to the actual animals. You know, if the animals wanted to hurt you, they could. You know, there's a thrill, or for me at least, there was a thrill when the first time that I was in a cage with a great white shark swam by, without even thinking about it, I reached out and stroked it. Incredible, the power that it felt. And I mean, there have been times where I've had questionable interactions. You know, like very early on in my career with the ocean, there was a large feeding frenzy in the middle of the ocean. There were tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of animals all attacking humongous bait balls, which is a lot of little fish, a lot of food, basically. And so birds were plummeting down from the sky like spears, and there were all sorts of fish charging everywhere, and there were lots of sharks. So I was on a very small boat with a few other guys. The captain was asleep, and two guys and I thought it would be a brilliant idea to get into the water to take photos. So we go into the water, and the instant we're in, we're surrounded by hundreds of silky sharks. And they're in a feeding frenzy, which is not a good time to be around sharks. I mean, you've got to be smart about this. They're in a feeding frenzy, which basically means they're just, you know, there's food and they're just snapping away at everything. It's just, you know, buffet line. So they're snapping when they're coming charging in at us, and we're screaming like little schoolgirls because, oh my God, and we're floated away from the boat. So we're back to back with each other, and we're kicking and you know, hitting and stuff, and sharks are coming in and we're getting knocked around. It only lasted, I don't know, 30 seconds, 60 seconds, 90 maybe, I doubt it, but something like that. It felt like forever. And the captain, in the meantime, had probably heard us screaming, so he woke up, grabbed us by the napes of our necks and pulled us aboard, screamed at us, which he was right to do. And then all of us had cameras, and he said, "You take any photos?" None of us had time or even thought to take a single photo because we were, you know, just in the middle of a feeding frenzy. So there, and the reason I'm telling you that it's not that the sharks were bad or that it's, you know, there's a reason to fear them. It's just humans being stupid. And, you know, in that case, me and two other guys, we put ourselves in a position that we shouldn't have been in. Lesson learned.
You were raised in a conservative Chinese family, and though you were born in Japan, when you were very young, you moved to the United States. Could you tell me about the different places that you lived in? What were they all like?
The best word probably to describe growing up was chaotic, confusing, chaotic, because switched environments pretty often, every couple years, every few years. You know, I lived up in the Northeast, in the Midwest, and down South, and moved around. And it was almost like moving to a different country every time. The language was different, the behavior was different, and certainly the kids were all different. and what was cool was different each time. And to top it off, I didn't really speak English very well. I didn't really fit in. I mean, I didn't fit in well. I had a few good friends, people who also didn't fit in probably. But it was difficult. I know a lot of other first generation Asian kids, Chinese or otherwise, and some of their families did really well at adapting and some didn't. You know, I guess it's just individual variation. Mine did not. So there was a lot more freedom that was given to people, kids, like say, I'm just gonna pick an age, say like 10, mm-hmm. say you're 10 years old. And, you know, the kids around me at that age were given a lot of freedom. They go over, hang out at friends' houses, stay over, sleep over, do whatever they wanted. I was not allowed to do any of that. That probably accounts for why I'm so rebellious. You know, I just got fed up. And like, for example, the ocean. I always had an interest in the ocean. I don't know why. As long as I can remember, you know, I read books about the ocean, watched programs about the ocean. Every time I got to the ocean, you couldn't drag me away. But anything to do with the ocean, my parents said was, you know, it's sort of dirty, it's dangerous, you get salty, you get sandy, you get dark, which is considered low class, you know, and all of that stuff. And so, you know, it was sort of not completely forbidden, but, you know, don't go to the ocean. The only thing you should do is study and become a doctor. That's it.
So you decided to leave home when you were 16 years old.
Yeah.
What was the plan?
Well, basically, when you're 16 or thereabouts, there is no plan. There is no plan. There was a big blow up at the end of high school. And then our PE teacher had helped to get me a job over the summer between high school and university at a summer camp, which got me away. It gave me a place to go. I was the only non-white person at a camp of hundreds of kids. It wasn't very difficult for anybody to recognize me. I would go up to do the announcements for the particular area that I was in charge of, and everybody be going, woo, which is obviously my last name, but, and it was kind of fun, you know, and the kids were good and became really good friends with some of them. So it was a good experience. And then the plan was for me to be a doctor, got into Brown, went there. I did actually have one thought in the back of my mind, which was that I wanted to go to Japan. I can't tell you exactly why I had that thought, but I did have that thought. I went to the Japanese department, introduced myself to the head of the department. There was a scholarship program to go to Japan for junior year. And I said, in 2 years time, you're going to send me in that program. And she laughed at me. And, you know, we had a nice conversation. And then I took her classes. And I was probably one of the worst students in the class. But I think I was entertaining to the professor. And, you know, she remembered what I'd said early on. And I was serious about it. She knew that. So when junior year came around and they picked me, that changed my life, actually. I moved to Japan, went to school. I lived with a family who spoke pretty much no English. I started when we entered school, university in Japan, you took a placement test and I scored pretty much at the bottom. So I was in the bottom of the lowest ranking class. And by the end of 3 months, we tested again and I scored top.
Wow.
Because I had time to concentrate on it, basically. And so that family that I stayed with, I'm still really good friends with them. You know, they sort of became my adopted family, you know, and then that, of course, led to employment. You know, I worked here in Japan and my wife is Japanese. So there were a lot of knock-on effects from that. So that one fateful day when I walked into the professor's office and said, you're going to send me to Japan, that pretty much changed my life.
Tony became an investment banker. He had his successful working life, but any spare time was spent in the ocean, diving and eventually taking photos too. He went on a trip to the Ogasawara Islands, 1,000 kilometers south of Tokyo. Tony's plan was to photograph dolphins, but while he was there, he befriended a couple who told him about the research they were doing tracking the movements of sperm whales. They're the largest toothed predator and loudest animal on Earth. Their echolocation clicks, which they use for navigating and hunting prey, can reach up to 230 decibels, the equivalent of standing next to a jet during takeoff.
And so I listened to them and I said, okay, I want to photograph them. And they looked at me like, what? What? I said, yeah, I want to photograph them. And they said, okay, yeah, but, you know, and they brought up all these reasons it would be difficult and stuff. I said, that's okay.
Why were they so surprised that you wanted to?
Well, because the sort of kind of accepted understanding of what it meant to be among sperm whales at the time was that they are the largest carnivores. They have huge mouths. You know, sperm whales kill people. You know, they attack and kill people. And that was sort of the kind of, the fishermen certainly kind of felt that way. And there's kind of a general sort of apprehension about being in the water with sperm whales. I mean, watching them from on a boat, fine.
So this was seen as an incredibly dangerous thing to do. But Tony was determined. Once the idea was in his head, he wanted to see it through. A few years later, in the year 2000, he finally managed to organize a 14-day expedition.
And for the first 12 days, we got hit by 4 typhoons in a row. And then on the 13th day, the final storm had passed. The oceans were still really rough. Talked to the captain and it's like, it doesn't look great, but let's give it a try. So we went out, say, mid-morning. There were still 2, 3, 4 meter swells, something on that order of magnitude. And they were still kind of messy. So, but we went out and we didn't see anything in the morning. And then probably around 12:31, something like that, we stopped to have some lunch and climbed up to the top deck and having our bento boxes, and then looked down and there was a fluke underneath us, the tail of a whale. And I was like, what? There's a whale underneath us. It's definitely a sperm whale. So we go in the water, float away from the boat. It was probably down 7, 8, 9 meters thereabouts, approximately hand distance in front of me was all black, and it was basically the whale. And so, which I did not expect, obviously. And I let out an expletive. I remember that. And then my air went out, of course, which is not ideal. And then the whale turned on its sonar. And the last thing that the captain said to me was, remember, if the whale turns on its sonar, it probably thinks you're food and it's going to eat you. And then, so I raced for the surface to try to get some breath. And this thing is coming after me with the sonar clicking at me. So I surfaced and it's still choppy. And then about a meter in front of me, the whale surfaced like a submarine, just whoosh. And it's still pounding with the sonar. It's a little bit painful, or it was a little bit painful. It was sort of a prickling hurt. And this thing was, you know, click, 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 click. Still being sloshed around in the water. And I kind of looked over my shoulder and my spotters, my safety spotters, were safely back on the boat, and the boat was 25, 30 meters away. So I was alone in the water. And I've got a camera in one hand and I've got my free diving fins on, which are the long fins. So it's not very easy to move. I'm trying to backpedal away very awkwardly as I'm being sloshed around. And the whale just decides to put me on its head. And I'm like, ah! I'm like, oh no, no. So the thought that is in my head that I clearly remember having was, push the whale away. And then I was trying to backpedal again, and this happened again. He put me on his head again. So we repeated many, many times. I'm gonna say somewhere between 1 and 2 minutes, probably in total. I was exhausted. I'd swallowed a lot of water. It turned slightly and I slid down, and then I felt kind of this tugging on my leg. I could look down and I could see that it had the tip of my fin in its mouth. I'm gonna die. You know, that was the thought in my head. And then the next thought is even sillier. It was like, okay, I have a camera in my hand, which gave me the energy, the panic and the energy to say, okay, before I die, I'm gonna, you know, take the best photos ever. And that's when I started swimming away. Then I turned around and I took a panic photo and then started swimming away again. And I did it a couple times. Once I started thinking rationally, it's like, wait a minute, it hasn't eaten me yet. If it wanted to eat me, it had plenty of opportunity. It could just chase me down and eat me right now. And it's following me, but it's not eating me. I think I turned left. and the whale follows. And then I turn right, and the whale follows. I turn left, and we keep doing this, and I'm like, oh my God, I have a big puppy dog. I'm not 100% confident because, you know, there's still this big animal following me, and it's the first time I've ever dealt with one. I turned around and I swam toward the animal for the first time, toward the animal. And then as I passed and I took a couple photos, I pulled the camera down and I looked in its eye. And the only thing I saw in its eye was curiosity. What are you? And so for the next 3 hours, and I had time to come up and change film, and you know, it just hung around the boat, and I go back in and then we go play again, and we just kept it up for 3 hours.
To go from thinking you were going to be eaten to having a photo shoot and a play with the same creature, it must have been completely transformative for your mind. How did you even begin to process all of that stuff?
It took a long time. Probably the most important thing that I learned was a lot of the things that we believe, we humans believe, we kind of just make those decisions and those beliefs up ourselves without consulting necessarily the subjects of those beliefs. You know, and sometimes we're right. You know, that would be the case. But sometimes we're also very wrong. Don't be so stuck on them as to not take the hint when the animal tells you otherwise. That has proven so useful. That is what that whale taught me. It was like, if I had stuck to what I was told and believed, I would have lost one of the most rewarding and certainly eventful and life-changing experiences ever. If I had been scared and just gotten out, arguably would have been the same thing to do. I wouldn't have had that change. And that has basically determined how I've dealt with every other encounter since, for everything.
That was Outlook's Emily Naylor speaking to wildlife photographer Tony Wu.